Sean Hughes.
Off the radar.
Right, welcome to Off the Radar with Sean Hughes. I don't know what time of the day you're listening to this at, but we're pitching it for just after your... I'm not pitching for anything. I'm talking nonsense. Ash Ditter is with me as my guest. Ash, how...
Hello.
Actually, also today, special guest... All the podcasts, they always just have a comic on, and comics are probably the best guests, but what we're trying to do slightly different is every so often just have just someone, not a person, but an occupation that I'm quite interested in. So we've got a doctor coming in today.
All right.
Just, he's going to talk us about with the NHS cuts and the like, and just, you know, I'm quite intrigued. Did your parents ever have any ambitions for you to become a doctor or anything like that?
They sort of realised early on that wasn't going to happen.
Were you really bad at operation?
I was terrible at operation and quite sort of academically stupid. So that was never really gonna. Also, I don't like the sight of blood or bones or people that often.
Right. So,
I wasn't cut out.
Well, actually, having said
that, the most GPs I've met, that's probably exactly what they're like as well.
But so how often do you go to see your GP then? I don't want it to get oh, there's something wrong with me when he comes in, you know, so.
I don't go that often, although I did go recently to have my, when you get to 40, you start getting letters saying you need your checkup. When you turn 41, suddenly you might die of prostate cancer.
I don't get those.
I've had them. And so you go, and I went for a checkup. I had my blood tests. And I had this doctor who was what do they call those doctors that aren't the real doctor? They just come in for the day.
Oh, that's a child dressed up in a fancy dress.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. And he was Serbian, which made me slightly scared anyway. And he said
proper
to me...
Proper bald skinhead.
Proper, tattooed, yeah. Right. You know, the whole thing. And he said... it was really quite distressing because I was getting my results. And I was a bit anxious because I'm a little bit overweight. And, you know, I drink a lot. And I'm not the healthiest person on earth. And he said to me, your cholesterol's a little bit high and you are overweight. You need to lose probably 2 stone. And I said, right. But he had this Serbian accent. Yeah. He said, I can't quite do it. He's like, you need to lose 2 stone. And I said, okay. And I said, well, how do you do that? He said, I had to lose 2 stone and I start running like motherfucker. If you run like motherfucker, you will lose 2 stone. I was like, and seriously, that's what he said to me in the thing. He said, and then he started, and I found that funny. So obviously he thought I was his friend.
Right.
So, and I suddenly, obviously at this point, I was thinking, actually, are you a doctor? Or have you just walked in? Are you actually valeting my car and you've walked in?
Right.
And he was going, you run like a motherfucker. And so I found this funny. And then he was going, because he had got this newfound confidence, he was going, because you are fat. And I was going, you can't say that. I said, you can't say that. I'm a patient. You can't say I'm fat. It was extraordinary. It was like a Nazi doctor. It was just, anyway, I didn't, and I went to the receptionist, and I said, that guy's really got bad, really, got a big problem.
Well, you reported him.
I did, because I said, look, he's got really bad, not that I was in bed, but his bedside manner is not, he's very aggressive.
Right.
He's very, very aggressive. And she said, oh, he comes across that way because he's Serbian. She said.
Well, there's a bit of truth in that.
He comes across like that because he said, I run like a motherfucker. That's why he comes across like that.
Well... No, because I've got a Croatian builder, and Croatian very similar to Serbia, real hard nuts, and he's the most gentle person. He loves heavy metal. He's got tattoos all over his leg with Megadeth and stuff like that. And just tell me, are you in a rock band? I say I'm finishing early. I have to practice for my rock band.
Right.
And but his way of, I remember I'll never forget, he just he just turns to me one day and says, I go home early, but I need to go to a special Croatian shop. You want me tomorrow to bring for you horse meat?
Right.
I'm just going, if, do you know anything about me at all? But and just really, and I remember, because I've got my dogs at home, and every time he goes, I love your dogs. But he said it in a way that, because of his accent, and he did mean it. He was saying, to me, it sounded like, I would kill your dogs.
And eat them.
Yeah, because he did that thing as well. He just went, I had a dog at home on farm, and it went into the next door neighbor's farm, and it ate some of his chickens. So the dog disappeared. We don't know what happened to him, but we do know. but if I ever find proof, I would kill that man.
Wow.
And I'm just going, so if you could paint the bedroom
yeah,
lilac?
That's quite scary. I remember a friend of mine had an au pair who was Croatian. Oh, was she Croatian? No, she was Czech. She was Czech. And, well, we're just being vaguely xenophobic. And she was really, really lovely girl. And then one day she said, is it okay if my father comes to stay? Is it okay if my father comes to stay? He's coming to England. Can my father come and stay in the house? And my friend, whose house it was, because she was the au pair, said, yeah, of course, you can come for a couple of nights. This guy turns up and he brings this really, like, unbelievably potent local whiskey from Czech. And so he goes, this is for you. So he goes, oh, that's very nice. And he drank a bit. He said, oh, God. And he said, no, we have tradition. And this is absolutely true. He said, we have tradition. And he said, right. So they all put the things down. He goes, right, you drink and then you laugh. So my mate said, oh, okay. So he drank it and went, oh, and then they all laughed. And he said, that's funny. He said, God, this is really strong stuff. He says, yes, you have to be very strong. We use this when we go to hunt the Jews.
Oh, God.
That's what he said.
Right.
That's what he said. And I was like, and my friend, who is Jewish, said, obviously felt a little bit uncomfortable and said, do you mean another word? Are you saying juice? Or are you saying somebody said, no, and he just went on and on and on about it. It's like, okay. And so we had this whole sort of middle class liberal London debate about what, you know, cultural differences.
He's still living there with them, yeah?
Yeah, well, yeah, not anymore.
But have you been to Prague?
No.
I went there and, my big memory of Prague is just getting in a taxi and asking the guy to take me somewhere. And I always, like, you know, try to talk to the locals. And I just chatting to him and went, I don't like people, don't talk. I'm thinking, you're probably in the wrong job then. Mm. You know, because that is pretty much the only people, you know, taxi drivers are the connection with the thing. And I think they've got a real chip on their shoulder about the whole communism and...
Well, it's probably understandable.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But, like, you know, you kind of, as we found out, you have to move on.
I spent a night in jail in Zagreb I was interrailing when I was 19. We got our passports taken by soldiers in the former Yugoslavia.
Because of your name.
Mainly probably because of my name. Soldiers took our passports, and this was when it was Yugoslavia. We got to Zagreb, and in those days we had traveller's checks to travel with.
We still do, though, don't we?
Do we?
Yeah.
But I didn't have a passport, so I couldn't cash any. So I went to the British Council, but I haven't got my passport. And they said, well... And they arrested us.
Well, the British Council?
Yeah, they got us arrested, and we spent a night in a jail, three of us. And then eventually... It was unbelievable. It was absolutely terrifying.
What was the charge, though?
Well, travelling without a passport. And I was like, well, how do you think we got in? And they were like, well, it doesn't matter how you got in.
But how did you get in there?
Well, we got over the border because we were interrailing on a train. It was a night train. They came in to check our passports, took them away, and never brought them back.
Oh, right. So you didn't tell that bit of the story, though, did you?
No, I told them. I was just busy going, look, I've never been to Afghanistan.
So, as I say, with the doctor, we're going to bring him in a minute, but so health-wise... Because, yeah. Basically, I want this podcast to be pretty much always... I always want my guests to be kind of a middle-aged person who just realises that, you know, your body... isn't the temple that you thought it was, really.
No, I'm not very healthy. But seriously, I don't feel very well most of the time. I feel fine, I'm not ill. I just feel a bit like not very well.
But that's probably what you're saying is not well, is that's the human condition.
Yeah, I think that's normal. I think I'm probably relatively normal. I think unless you're really fit and you do lots of weird things, I think you just don't feel very well.
But you're at that age as well where you will start doing things. Like I ridiculously joined a gym and it was like just thrown. It's like I could have just went to the reception, just burnt money in front of them going, here, I'd like to pay for this. I'm never coming in. But
I've recently started running and someone said to me.
Like a motherfucker?
Yeah, like a motherfucker. And there's an app you can get. It's really, and it tracks your running, you know, like a GPS. So it kind of motivates you. And I quite like it. I've only been about three times. But you put it in your pocket. But I don't know how to... yet, because I haven't really spent much time with it, keep the volume down. So when you're running, it will suddenly say, you have been running for 5 minutes. You have run 50 yards or whatever it is at approximately 16 miles. You know, and it's just, but it seems that every time it says it, I'm running past someone. And it's always basically saying, you really are fat and you can't run. And it's a deeply embarrassing thing. But it motivates you to carry on going because it weirdly does keep you going, running.
Yeah. So, see, this is the thing. One of modern life's little quirks of people paying for personal trainers. And it is just someone to just go on then.
Yeah.
And you're paying them like 40 quid an hour to go on.
Yeah.
That's all you're paying for. Ooh, yeah.
It sort of is. And then you feel guilty. I did that for a while. I got one. And I spent a lot of time ringing him up at 10 past 11 at night going, I'm not going to make it. I'm just not going to get there. It's a difficult, I can't really explain it. But it's just, I don't understand all those things. It's hard. It's just hard. You just have to sort of accept. But I've noticed a lot of people my age suddenly do embrace it and they get into it. And it's a crisis of some kind.
Well, no, I think it's like exercise is a bit like an addiction. And as you get into it, like anyone who does exercise, they just go, yeah, once you're into it, I love that so much. And it's just that kind of.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. I'm sure it is true, and it is. I mean, if I have the occasional run, I do feel, for an hour afterwards, I feel really good.
In what way, though?
Just feel like that you genuinely feel it all rushing through you, and you feel like your blood is moving around your system again, and you feel like you haven't got, horrible lactic acid build-up in your legs. And
I don't even know what lactic acid is.
Really. I don't know what it is, but I know it's in your legs.
I know, but it just sounds horrible.
And you do feel better for it, but the trouble is with running and fitness, there's nothing in the bank. So if you do it and then you don't do it, it's not like you can pick it up again. You start from naught.
Right. But we will bring the doctor in now. Yeah. So we have, this is unbelievable, but apparently... So your name is Dr. Holmes?
Dr. Holmes.
So, Dr. Holmes, thank you so much for coming in. You're a little bit younger than us, so... Well, let's talk about the NHS cutbacks. How have they affected, generally, GPs?
I think at the moment there's a general feeling that that concern is going to get greater going forwards.
Well, listen, thank you so much for coming in. Really appreciate it. So Ash, we've got a couple of questions from the viewers here now as well. Mm. So what do you think of Mike in York? Is Brian May's defence of badger culling admirable, or should famous folks stay away from trendy campaigns?
They should say nothing about anything, in my view.
Well, it's odd because... Like, Brian May's been, he's not, a new celebrity, but I don't remember him ever mentioning badgers ever before.
No, I think he might have jumped on some sort of bandwagon there.
Because it wasn't Bohemian Rhapsody, phenomenal, brilliant songs this year. What about the badgers?
Yeah. Or was it actually about badgers?
Well, no, but then he could have went, well, that's about badgers, by the way.
It is, yeah. He's come to it late in life. It would be interesting to go back over the Queen back catalogue and see...
I wonder why my bicycle could be about going out to see badgers.
Yeah.
That's,
Yeah.
We are the champions. That could be about badgers. We Will Rock You, that was written by a badger, wasn't it?
I think it was written for a badger.
Okay.
I think that was what he all said.
Yeah.
To be fair, I do remember that interview.
Yeah.
It was. Or was it Roger Taylor who said it? One of them definitely said that was written for a badger.
I think they were all into badgers, but they were kind of... I think he was a spokesman for the badgers.
Yeah.
I think he's always been into badgers, actually, so...
Didn't Freddie Mercury split a badger in half one? That was a different story.
I think that was Led Zeppelin. Led Zeppelin, yeah. Because it's... But I guess it was... I guess, to be fair to Brian May, his life has gone along fairly cushy, I'm sure they struggled a bit at the start. I think, there's two points here. One is I think you realise that you've kind of lost your mojo when they let you do a guitar solo because you just go, nobody really wants to hear that since 1985.
No.
But
on top of Buckingham Palace.
Well, no, that's funky to do that. But and the hair, the silhouette, that was fantastic. Yeah. You couldn't light something like that, is what I'm saying.
No.
But I guess maybe Brian May was always into the badges, but... They weren't being cold back then, so he didn't have to kind of bring
there
up
was
big
no,
guns.
There was no fight.
Yeah.
I'd like to think that his massive country house is overrun with badgers now, just sort of taking refuge in his garden.
He's kind of put himself into a corner there. Like, if he kind of all of a sudden wakes up one morning and goes, I don't like badgers anymore. He's kind of stuck with that whole...
This is the problem. If you start being vociferous about a cause and then you wake up one morning and think, I don't care about this cause anymore, you've got to keep going with it.
Yeah.
You've just got to keep going with it. It's like Paul McCartney doesn't go on so much about vegetarianism anymore. Have you noticed that?
About his...
Vegetarianism. He doesn't really go on about that anymore.
Well, that was more Linda, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, but he kind of embraced the whole thing.
Yeah.
And now he seems to avoid the issue slightly.
He doesn't avoid the issue.
Doesn't he?
Well, I don't think it's ever come up where, he's in the middle of the interview and they go, so, would you be having a lunch? But I'm out of here. Don't ever
No, I just
again.
Think, you know, I don't know.
Brian, come in and talk about badges.
You've got to be careful about being really, you know, being really angry about an issue, because ultimately I find that I change my mind about everything all the time.
Well, that's the only way to be. But has there ever been a celebrity that said something that you actually... Because like, I've spoken about in another programme, like Morrissey was the reason why I became vegetarian. A reason, not the reason. But was there any, you know, kind of celebrity that really got you kind of interested in the thing?
That's a good question. I don't think... In a celebrity that got me interested in something, no, I mean, not in a serious way, no. Charlie Nicholas, maybe not, like, drinking.
What about, because Lee from Blue, he was very fond of the elephants or something. He didn't like them being, because remember he did that famous, after the terrorism, 9/11, he just went, yeah, what about the elephants?
The problem with terrorism, there are many problems, yeah. I think, with terrorism. But I think one of the problems there is it has deflected from other issues. Like, and I think people like Lee from Blue.
Yeah.
Need to say that stuff.
Do you think he's changed his name, Deedpool, to Lee from Blue now? So he just, nobody knows his surname.
Have they got back together?
Yeah, yeah.
Have they?
Yeah. But what do you think of all those nostalgia things? The Big Reunion was a fantastic programme. Did you watch it?
No.
See, that's the only reason why I wish I had kids, because I probably wouldn't watch stuff like that. But you're too busy.
But is that when all the bands got back together again?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I didn't see that. But I don't know. Nostalgia is... seems to be most stuff on telly is nostalgic now.
Yeah.
They try and make it nostalgic.
But the nostalgia thing, like, I love it when, like, and they sell out arenas and stuff with just people trying to, it's pretty much like people, like, anyone who's ever gone out with an ex, you just know that's not going to work. And how are they expecting a good night? They're not 17 anymore. They're not, I love that they just go, oh, Blue, that was all about, you know, that just reminds me of when I was growing up and all the songs like that. But, like, even when you see them, they don't know the lyrics. They just know the chorus. You know, they all rise. They go, arise. And they just, I don't think there is actually, I don't think there is lyrics. I think they're quite.
That's it. That's all they've got. I mean, sometimes you do see these. I saw one on telly where, what's the guy from Spandau Ballet called?
Tony Hadley.
And he was on it. And he was singing, I think he had to sing something that wasn't his, I don't know what the show was. He had to sing something that wasn't one of his songs. And he slightly butchered it, and it wasn't very good, and it sounded a bit flat, and everyone was going, oh, it's not very good. But now you can sing Gold, which is your own song, and then he did it even worse. And actually, halfway through it, I genuinely forgot the lyrics. And
what was this
song? It was some kind of, I don't know what it was. It was like pop star to something else. There was a transformation from...
Yeah, gotcha.
But they were like... I mean, I saw him in a pub once. I don't know why I'm obsessing about him now, but I saw him in a pub once, and he was having a fight with his wife. In a pub in somewhere in London, having an actual proper row with his wife, and somebody walked up to him and said, Tony, calm down. And I'm thinking, that must be the worst thing.
But
about
his mate or just a stranger?
No, just a stranger who felt that he knew him because of his music. And I kind of loved that.
But how did Tony react?
Told him to fuck off.
Did he really?
He did. He told him to fuck off.
And then did that kick off?
And no, he sort of said, no, I'm just saying, I just think, you know, you need to let... But what was interesting is this person had the right, because he was Tony Hadley, to kind of... You know, normally he's just steamed in and gone, what are you doing? But he had to... It became personal. It was kind of quite weird.
I saw... he seems to be enjoying himself, so who am I to tell anyone what to do? But Alexander Armstrong's trying to become a serious singer now.
Really?
Yeah, I saw him on some daytime programs singing... Yeah. Doing a version of Girls Just Want to Have Fun.
Right.
But a slightly kind of swing version. Right. You know, the guy from Pointless.
Is he any good?
Well, like, he's passable, but he's not going to...
But the other bloke did that, didn't he? Hugh Laurie.
Yeah, I know. I didn't buy into that
at all.
He's
a blues singer now.
Yeah.
Why is he a blues singer? What's he got to be bluesy about?
Look, that's a ridiculous statement.
Why?
You can be the most successful person in the world and you can still get the blues. So I'm not taking that. That's nonsense.
You're sitting at Eton going, God, I just feel the blues.
Yes, no, you can, and that's a nonsense what you're saying.
£12 million a year, I feel the blues.
Well, you can. Like, you're better than that, Ash Ditter. You are better than that.
I don't care. It's like, you know.
No, you're talking nonsense there. I'm not letting you away with that one. But it's just that thing of, like, it's that, because I think at one point he was the most, he got paid the most as an actor on American television.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And even more than Bruce Willis. Yeah. And he, but like, it was that thing of, so they went, so then, like, the record companies went, well, let them do a blues album.
Yeah.
And he's not, they're not great, you know, they're fine, there's nothing wrong with them.
But why
and,
do people have to do things that they don't do? I don't understand that. Why do people have to do things that they don't do? Like, you know,
badger culling.
Like, yeah, why is he getting himself into badger culling? or not bad. No, but why? I don't understand it. It's one of my big gripes. It's like, why do, if you're really good at something, what's wrong with just being really good at it? Why do you then have to go, I want to go and be really good at this? And you won't be, you'll be awful at it. Or it'll be something, it's like that, you know, like the dancing. I know that's a different thing.
Yeah.
But it's just nauseating. I don't want to see newsreaders dancing. I don't want to see it. I don't find it funny. I'm not going to give anyone money.
Yeah, but the thing is also, like, people of a certain age will realise that, like, when Angela Rippon did that on Morecambe and Wise, that was never going to be better anyway. So no. It's all a backward step. But no, I can understand why people just want to test themselves. But there is a slight self-indulgence of, like, the likes of Hugh Laurie just going on. Like, and I think he sold, well, people go, well, he sold 3 million records. But of course he's a famous person. People are just going to go into Tesco's and go, I've heard of him. But that's the record I'm buying. Yeah.
But that's all they're interested in. Isn't that all they want to do? I mean, isn't that...
No, I don't...
Is he good? He might be very good.
He's all right, but I just think, like, because he's famous, people indulge him for other things. And that happens quite a bit. You know, we kind of need to put our foot down and go, no, you're not. I think people should be told, you know, because it's just that, you know, polite society. It's like, rather than at a party chance someone to fuck off, you just go, I'm just going to the toilet, even though that's what you're saying. And that's what people are doing now. They're going to go, well, we'll have you on our show, and... That'll be a little phase that he'll go through and he'll sing his couple of songs, and then, you know, it's just a thing they'll go.
When are you acting again?
I
met a kid the other day. This is the thing, I don't. You know, you're talking about, you have a lot of people on here sort of a certain age, and I met a guy the other day. He's 22. What I think we have to embrace as a generation is we don't understand other generations, nor should we try to. It's like the Russians. We don't know those people. We don't know what Russians mean. We don't know what they do. And it's the same with young people. We don't know them.
What about young Russians?
Yeah, well, no chance.
Right.
This kid, right, he's got 2 million followers on YouTube. He's got a YouTube channel. And I met him because they want to do a sitcom with him because he's got 2 million viewers. Yeah. So I met him to say, do you want to write a sitcom? So I said, no, but I'll meet him. Met him. He said to me, so I looked at his thing. I'm not going to say who he was, but I looked at his thing.
Why
literally,
not?
He's obviously brilliant because he's got 2 million viewers. But he just does little podcasts every day where he says, so, you know, I got up today. God, it's a nightmare. I met my girlfriend. She's late for an hour. I hate when she's late. And anyway, I've got to go because my dad's given it all that. And I'll speak to you later.
Sounds good.
That's it. And 2 million kids watch this and go. And then you see the comments underneath.
Is this British kids or American?
Yeah, British. It's all in Britain. And he's got he wrote a song, and because of his followers, he got it into the top 10.
Right,
which is obviously he just recorded in his house. Terrorist.
Did this guy ever leave his house?
I met him in his house. But he said to me, what else do you want to do then? He said, well, I'm going to write a novel. I'm going to write a novel and my followers will buy that and it'll become a bestseller. He said, and then when I've done that, my absolute ambition in life is to write an episode of Doctor Who. And I said, well, that'll be more difficult, won't it? Because that's not about followers. That's about somebody saying, do you want to write an episode of Doctor Who? And he said, yeah, no, that's what I'm doing. It was sort of incredible to me because he was just, his horizons were completely different to my horizons now, let alone when I was 22. It was, everything was possible. And all you need to do is just do it and then people will follow you. And he makes a fortune. YouTube pay him every month, fortune, to keep doing it. He gets a salary, he gets 10, 15 grand a month.
What, and so what, they get advertisers on?
Yeah.
And
fair play to him. But he literally, he's just saying, God, dear, I tied one on last night. And and that's it.
But see, the thing is, I don't understand it because, like, basically, when the internet came in as well, they said, hey, this is going to be great, you know, forget about TV commissions and stuff. We can make our own stuff. It's going to be brilliant. And to a degree, this is what the podcasts are about.
Yeah.
But you kind of do that and you go, well, yeah, we'll probably get a reasonable amount of people listening, but we're not going to get 2 million. And I don't understand how this kid, like you might have been doing him a discredit by the way you described his show, but I doubt if you were.
You know... You look on those YouTube channels, and he's a perfectly nice kid. I liked him, I really liked him, but he's literally is quite banal what he's talking about.
But how did he get those followers? I don't understand that.
He's been doing it for 2 years, and you subscribe to his channel or you don't, and so basically he somehow connected with people who watch YouTube, with young kids who watch YouTube. So he understands his. He's really brilliant because he understands what their problems are. So he'll just say, you know, he started off as, you know, as a sixth former doing it, and he was sort of talking about the problems he has going to school. And
so basically what's happening here is kids who are a bit bored will just Google in problems with acne or something, and then they'll hit his channel at some point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's
yeah,
That's absolutely how they do it.
And then they go, oh, I quite like him. And then, but I think there's a thing about, it's the soap opera thing. There's a thing about, he does it, it's every day, just does 10 minutes every day. And they'll just tap into him and see what he's been up to. So he becomes this sort of virtual star, you know. And he says to me, you know, he said he went to see a gig recently at Wembley or something, and he was surprised, because he never leaves his house. He was surprised that when he got there, some people recognised him, and then some more people recognised him. And suddenly they were all screaming, like, I was a pop star. He said, and I said, well, you are a pop star. You had a top 10 hit. He said, yeah, but I'm not really a pop star. I'm not really anything. And he has that awareness. He's like, I'm not really anything. I just tell people about my day, and they seem to get into it.
But there's a lot of that about now, isn't there?
Like, yeah.
You look at Katie Price, and, you know, she's got all that. But then people do buy her books and stuff.
She's a huge best-selling author, isn't she?
I know, just amazing, really. Like, obviously, I haven't read any. I don't think she has either, to be fair. But
no, or written any.
No, that's what I mean. I'm not being, that wasn't a funny joke. Like, I don't,
no.
She doesn't. I think the what happens is she goes, all right, well, I want this one to be about a guy who, he has a car crash, and he has his face disfigured, and he's loved his life, tells him to go away, but then she learns to love him again. If you write that, and put my name on it. And that's what she does. And then her friend goes, I'll make that into a novel for you.
Yeah, I think what we're saying is it's all very cynical, everything at the moment. Well, we think it is. It probably isn't that cynical. I had a discussion with my girlfriend the other day, who's more in touch with youth culture than I am, let's say. And she was saying to me, yeah, you just think everything's rubbish now because that's what you're supposed to do. It isn't. And I don't think that at all. But I do think it is much more cynical how things are marketed and how things, everything is just with PR to within an inch of its life. I don't think anyone knows what anything actually is. And that's the point of it, I suppose.
Well, I guess, like, you know, it's a generational thing as well, where just the kids just want to do the thing, and that's great.
Yeah.
But I want to talk to you because, like, essentially you're a scriptwriter now anyway.
Yeah.
And, like, I just, like, I find it, like, this must really, when you're talking about things that go through the net, like, there's so many things now where you look at, like, I watched Top Boy. Did you watch Top Boy?
Yeah, I saw a bit of it, yeah.
And I thought it was very well done.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like, you could tell, like, it was weird because for people who don't know it, it's like, you know, Hackney and it's black culture, street culture, it's drugs. Yeah. It's pretty much, you could, but written by a Northern Ireland guy. But he did it very well. He did have the power and all that. Obviously, he authenticated the whole thing. Mm. But it was kind of them going, we're going to do our version of The Wire. But then, like, what I don't understand is how it gets through with the massive holes in the thing. Because the whole premise of it was, oh, my God, they killed a guy and there's a witness and there's a chances are if he talks, they're going to prison. That's the whole, you know, journey of the idea. Yeah. And then they get on with the things. And then, so that's what they hold it on. And then everything else happens. But everything else happens, there's people killing people left, right and centre, not worrying about witnesses anytime else.
Apart from that same, that one murder is the only one that matters.
Yeah, the police are going,
being laying waste to thousands of other people.
They're just going to shoot fellas in the head and alleyways and Albany, go gunning the person to death. And it's kind of going, none of them get caught and there's no witnesses. But
yeah, what about that kid?
So things like that must drive you, well, it drives everyone crazy, but...
Well, as a writer, yeah, I mean, I don't know, it's hard. I mean, crime thrillers is what everyone writes. Everyone wants a crime thriller, that's all they want. They want police, they want crime. And it's kind of, it is weird. I mean... you know, to my girlfriend, she's an actress. She literally, I think the last five jobs she's done, she plays a girl, probably a prostitute, who gets murdered. Right? And now every drama you watch on British telly, this is, you know, me ending my career right now, every drama you watch on British telly starts with a girl or a child being murdered. And it's like, who gives a shit? I'm just like, what about, we don't need to do that. There are other ways of doing things. There are other ways of just...
But it's weird how things come into vogue as well, because recently it seems to be, hey, here's the way we're doing it for the next 3 years. We're going to tell you who the killer is in the first shot. Mm, you're with us all the way. And now they're doing that for a while, aren't they?
Yeah, but I was saying it's like, they're all, you know, why are we, you know, because of the killing. So they're now doing that. And who done it over 15 hours or whatever. And it's brilliant. You know, it is. It's just another way of doing it. And everyone's looking for another way of doing it. And actually, we should be making our own stuff up instead of going, let's do a show a bit like that, or let's do a show a bit like that.
But
they don't. That's the terrifying risk for them.
That's the media, is they go, they look at success and they go, let's do something quite similar.
Yeah, which will obviously be nowhere near as good.
Well, and sometimes it can be even better, but I'm just saying it's a terrible way of looking at things.
Yeah, but it's just fear. It's all fear.
Because would you say, like, your favourite TV show of all time is The Sopranos.
Yes.
And so, like, I love The Sopranos, but, you know, not as much as you do. What is it you love so much about it?
I just love the fact, one of the things I hate as a scriptwriter, the one note I can't take is when people go, he's not very likable. And every time they do that, part of the fact it's normally being said by one of the least likable people you'd ever like to meet, is the fact that I always say to them, right, just watch the pilot of The Sopranos. In the first 5 minutes, he kneecaps someone, a relatively innocent, normal bloke, batters him almost to death. And you're thinking, but 5 minutes later, he's worried about his kids' results. And you go, oh, I quite like him.
Yeah.
He's the most lovable man on television. Yet, and he's got that thing that we all want to do. There's some amazing scenes in that where they just juxtapose those true human feelings, which is there's part of all of us that wants to be able to take out the robber and actually just batter him. Yeah. But we're not those people. And it's sublime.
If that makes it sound like, you know, Cockneys will love their mums.
No. Well, it is a bit like that. But it's about a moral code, isn't it? And I think everyone's got their own moral code, and most of us have the same moral code, but some people don't. And I think it's so brilliant and insightful about being a human, that show, in a way that so many other shows just don't try and do.
But also what they did better than, again, with the thinking outside the box, was their casting. Because over here, again, like, you could have an amazing script and then they just give it to...
Well, that's the biggest bugbear I've got here.
Ross Kemp.
Which is that Ross Kemp does everything. No, it's not necessarily him, bless him. It's the fact that one of the reasons I think we love those shows is because we don't know who anyone is. You watch The Killing, you watch an episode of a British drama here, and you go, Ian McKellen's in this. I expect he probably did it. Because he's really famous and no one else is. And you just think, they give everything. It's just so unimaginative. You watch The Killing, you don't know who anyone is. You can involve yourself entirely in the story.
But to be fair, there's a little bit of that, because we're too at home with our culture, so we kind of understand things. Like, we buy into that, I don't know what Swedish people are like. You know, a bit like you were saying about Russians. So they've got that going for them as well. But I must say, it's probably still my favourite moment ever on television was the Ross Kemp on This Morning. And this was in the midst of his out there with the boys in Afghanistan
stuff, right?
And which I thought were great programs, by the way. And he just did this, you know, really heartfelt interview for 10 minutes about, you know, one of them didn't come back, and, you know, I went to visit their parents, and, you know, because I just felt I was part of their life now. And like, it was like a beautiful interview, and like, really about how he really, you know, took them for the boys and was living with them and all that. And they're just going, really showed a really good side to him. And then Philip Schofield just goes, well, thanks for it. You know, the way they do that, you know, they put their earnest voice and go, thank you very much, Ross. And Ross goes, but just before I go, if I could just say, I'm in Panto in Wimbledon from... And I was going, for God's sake...
I'm playing Widow Twanky.
Absolutely. I'm just going, God, you've no idea the self-awareness of you just ruined a whole moment for everyone there.
No, but that's the thing, we forgot that bug bit. It's that weird thing. I think with I can't speak for you, but I'm about the only person left I know who bores... I'm still boring about all that stuff about... I mean, not Ross Kemp, for God's sake. It's not like he's selling out. But, you know, and what is selling out? Who cares anymore anyway? But that is that weird thing of the constant... It's the constant selling. It's the constant selling of everything. Stuff.
I just got rid of my PR because I just went, I just don't like, if less people come along, so be it. Like, you know, I'd rather do something like this, a podcast, where we go, we might take a punt and go to see him. SeanHughes.co.uk, by the way, if you want to check out the dates. But, you know, but I don't think that's selling. But it is that thing of, I just, like, you know, talking to people on the phone from local papers and then quite literally, you know, I'm doing the last few dates of the show about my father dying, and that's what it says in the press release. It tells them the whole thing. This guy couldn't be bothered to even read the press release, and he goes, Sean, so you're best known for Nevermind the Buzzcocks, and I'm thinking, well, I'm not, but there you go. You have that. And he goes, so you're best known for Nevermind the Buzzcocks. What would you say the difference between Buzzcocks and doing stand-up is? I'm going, well, are you a bit thick, are you? Well, it's one's a panel show, and the other one I'm slung on my heart up and soul out, you know, trying to tell people about stuff. They go, right, yeah. And then, like, I love it with local papers. Once they run out of ideas, they always go, have you been to Oxford before? Do you like it?
Yeah,
that's them out, like, you know.
Yeah, but it's local interest.
Yeah, but it's kind of, I find it, I don't do myself any favours as well, because As you know, I never do. I try to kind of burn as many bridges as possible.
Yeah, you are an island.
Yeah, but it's I always slag off the local paper on stage.
Yeah.
So they just go, well, we won't even interview him next time. We won't put any press in. So I'm getting to the point where I never went into it as a career, so I hate saying the word career, even though everyone seems to be career-oriented in comedy now. Actually, I found it quite funny, actually. I heard John Bishop on the radio selling his autobiography, complaining about the young comics who are only in it for stadiums.
Was he really?
I'm telling you, he just said when we were doing it, we didn't realise it was going to be about arenas. But now there's just comics starting off thinking they're going to do arenas. And going, well, we opened the doors in the late 90s for you guys, and you've brought it all back to the 70s kind of sensitivities and sensibilities.
Yeah, comedy is very set 1970s now.
Absolutely,
it really is. People love it. Yeah, he sounds like he's being a little bit disingenuous there.
Well, no, I think he actually did really think it. Like, you know, I guess we're all in our own little bubble. But what I'm saying is, like, I'm getting to the point where
it's amazing how often John Bishop comes up in casting conversations. When you're writing a drama, somebody will say, "Do you know what would be interesting? John Bishop."
Mm. Well, that's because he's everywhere, and that's how people operate in that thing. I'm hoping the way my kind of live coverage is going is, because I don't really want to do interviews, I'm having to do it like a census. I'm having to go around door to door. I'm just going, I'm playing up the road.
Yeah.
That's pretty much...
You should get some canvases.
Little
Sean Hughes rosettes knocking on doors.
But so, look, we're going to finish off this particular chat. So what are you working on at the moment then? Or is that... Because these things...
Well, having made a speech about...
Speech?
About selling out and people doing things that they shouldn't be doing, I've just written a body swap comedy about... A married couple who wake up in each other's bodies.
That sounds good.
While my, 100,000-page novel about the sea is on hold. I've done that, and I've just written a film about a bunch of middle-aged men who...
Have you thought of John Bishop for that?
Yeah, well, I tell you what, this one, the other one I've written, is about a bunch of middle-aged men who set up a synchronized swimming team, which is based on a documentary. His name comes up a lot in those casting meetings.
And mine never does, though.
Not in terms of acting, no.
Right. We're just going to... Sort of who's that waving in at the window at you?
Get rid of that nutcase.
Well, listen, this has been Ash Jeter and Dr. Holmes. Thank you so much for being my guest today. You've been listening to Off the Radar with Sean Hughes. Tune in again.
Sean Hughes.
Off the Radar.
A Big Things Media production.
Big Things.